Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there, loyal Athletic Support listeners. If you've been tuning in over the last couple of months, you've heard all about the Game Time app and how it can save you some serious cash on last-minute tickets to sports, concerts, all types of shows. The Game Time app, what's cool about it is that you can literally see the view from your seat in the app before you buy the tickets. And then once you've chosen the ticket, it's two-tap checkout. You only have to tap two times. There's two taps, and you're out, and you have your tickets. You're done. And you're going to be, next thing you know, you're at your event. So if that's not good enough, well, now Game Time is hooking you up for the holidays with $10 credit. Here's what to do. You download the Game Time app in the Google Play or App Store, click on the My Tickets section of the app, create an account, then under the billing section, punch in the redeem code THEATHLETIC. Once again, THEATHLETIC, all one word, for $10 off your first purchase. That is free money, people. Credit is only available to the first 1,000 people who redeem the code, and it expires at the end of the year, meaning December 31st, 2019. So move quick on this and score last-minute tickets. Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Athletic Support. We are Friday, December 20th. I'm Arpan Basu, and if you are somewhat shocked to hear my voice first, it's because I've never done this intro before. Marc-Antoine Godin could not join us today, so it is I doing the introduction. I feel somewhat awkward and abandoned and quite anxious that Marc-Antoine's not next to me, but we do have a replacement for Marc-Antoine, and that's our good friend Sean Gordon, who is in Edmonton this morning with the Canadians, getting ready for their game, their Hockey Night in Canada game on Saturday, against the Oilers. Sean, how you doing over there?
I'm great. Thank you. It's a lovely day in Edmonton. It's, sunny, not too cold. I was an intern here at the Edmonton Journal in the early 1990s, and, the coldest I've ever been was when I, there was the first week or the second week, it was minus 60 or something. It was just ridiculous anyway. So I have great memories of Edmonton and also not so great ones.
Yeah, but you'll be very happy to know that when I initially assigned you this trip, you were, I'm sure it was positive in your mind that you were going to be in the bitter cold and we were going to be in the mild climes of the eastern time zone. Meanwhile, we are sitting in 20 below frigid Nordic temperatures and you are in the relatively balmy conditions in northern Alberta. So win for Sean Gordon.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, one for the good guys. What can
you
I
showed
tell you?
Absolutely. You showed who is boss, you know. So that's good. So listen, Sean, we were at the midway point of this road trip. And I find I feel like there's a bit of a sense of deja vu because I was the one covering this road trip last season, not the one in Western Canada, but the one just before Christmas. And and the similarities in the conditions under which the Canadians went on this road trip from last year to this year are remarkable. They're really insanely similar. And last season, the Canadians actually lost the first game of this trip. This trip was a 3-game trip last year in Colorado, Arizona, and Vegas. And what happened is they had their good loss, which I would argue this time around was the Philly loss in the midst of the 8-game winless streak. But last year, this good loss was in Colorado, the first game of that trip. And then in Arizona, they played okay, not great. Price played on his head and basically won them that game. And then they played an outstanding game in Vegas and came back in the last minute with a goalie pulled and scored their first overtime goal of the season. And it really sent them on a little bit of a wave of playing really well. So as far as I can tell, if we look at all the similarities this season between what happened last season and this season, the Canadiens are a bit ahead of the game because they've played two really, really good road games in their last two, I find. I don't know how you feel and kind of can you get a – do you have a sense from the guys that they're actually feeling something turning here?
I do, actually, and I think it is an interesting similarity. And what is interesting also in terms of being ahead of the curve is that they're also doing it with three rookies. And you know, Nick Suzuki – he might have been their best forward against Calgary, and he was also very good in Vancouver. Cale Fleury has sort of found a new gear. Ryan Poehling has a plan now, and so you're right. Like they did have their good loss, quote unquote, a little earlier in the game in the season, and when you look at how it was that they were able to win, this is sort of the piece that I wrote at Calgary. That to me is the most revealing thing. It's that they look like the Canadiens. They're playing quick. They're prioritizing quality over quantity, although they're getting lots of quantity as well. 5-on-5, they're ahead of the game. They're clearly, ahead of the competition, I think, in terms of 5-on-5 play. And they've been able to survive their mistakes. And I think that that's interesting as well because the penalty kill has gotten greasy a couple of times here, particularly on Calgary's second goal of the game the other night. That was there. I counted about five lateral passes before that went in.
That was a seam pass special.
And that was the sort of thing where it's like, yeah. I've had conversations with these guys, particularly Nate Thompson, about this. And it is hammered into them. This is the first thing top of mind when they come over the boards to go onto the ice. And they had, like I said, it was open access. They could do whatever they wanted. And so despite all of that, they are still keeping their cool. They are still keeping their poise. They are still grinding away and trusting that being able to play 5-on-5 with anybody, being able to use whoever players they need to plug into the bottom six, it's going to be just fine. And so I do think that there is a similarity in the sense that this is a trip that it could have gone poorly for them, particularly in Vancouver. I think they gave up a lot of really good chances to the Canucks in that game. Price, I think, was great. I think he's been terrific since the 1st of December, more or less. And from that standpoint, here they go. But again, because they've won the first two games, it means that they have a little bit less pressure in the final two games of what is going to be a pretty tiring set here.
Yeah, they do. And I think that this is a characteristic of this team that I find is been repeated enough times that we can say that this is part of their identity, is that when they're left for dead is when they really bounce, they really stand up and kind of show themselves. What you would like for this team to show is to not be left for dead, for them to yeah. avoid these situations where everyone has lost all hope in them. At which point they'd like take offense to that and decide like, no, we're full of hope and we're still in it and we're gonna show you what we are. Well, geez, we'll do that before you get to that point. That would be an interesting kind of shift in their identity. But this is, it's almost impossible to argue at this point that when everyone loses hope in this team and when everyone starts kind of slamming them and saying, okay, well, here are all the deficiencies. They're too small. They're too this. They're too that. When all that comes out, that's when they stand up and say, hang on one second. This is what we're about. And really all of last season was based on this knowledge. I remember, you know, Paul Byron, Brendan Gallagher, there were a number of guys on the team who made it a point of reading all the preseason predictions and knowing exactly what everyone thought of them and knowing exactly. And they used that as fuel for last season and all training camp and all, the whole, like that's all they thought about all summer. And we're not shy to mention it. They're like, listen, we know what you guys think of us and we're going to prove you wrong. And they kind of thrive on that. But man, it'd be nice for them to like it'd be nice for them to prove people right for once in a while, you know, like actually lead people to actually think that they're good and then go out and show that they're good. Because every time people think that they're good, they start playing poorly. And then when people think that they're bad, they start playing well.
You know, it's interesting. I've sort of felt that even during the losing streak, I think there were some people inside the room who were a little perplexed at some of the hysteria, because it wasn't as if they were flat out terrible in every facet of the game, consistently unable to compete, and that they'd given up. Like, it's funny because you talk to people about turnarounds and all this sort of stuff, and it was interesting talking to Carey Price about it last night after the game, which was, so now that you've kind of rediscovered, he's like, whoa, wait a minute here. He's like, we know, essentially what he said was, we know, I'm paraphrasing of course, we know who we are. We know what we have. We know what we can give. And we were able to give more of it tonight, but the fact is that we're getting more breaks than we were, and we were never as terrible as people thought we were in the 8-game winless streak. And he says, I get the corollary of that is they're probably not as good as winning 6 of 8. And so I find that interesting, because I do think that there was a lot of belief, and that there is a lot of self-awareness around this team now. And I think it comes down to the type of leadership that they have, the veteran players that they have, and also the younger players. I mean, whether the younger players know what they have in themselves, I mean, the veterans know what they have in Nick Suzuki. They know what they have in Cale Fleury. They know what they have in Jesperi Kotkaniemi. They know what they have in Victor Mete. And so on down the list. Paling, they're starting to figure out, I think, what they have in Paling. And it's interesting also because, like, I was joking around with Arturi Lehkonen after the game yesterday, saying, okay, has Yoel Armia finally...
Wait.
Oh, we're going to get into that in a minute?
You were joking around with Arturi Lehkonen?
I was joking around with Arturi Lehkonen. He had a big smile on his face.
Was he joking around with you?
I can't pretend, I didn't mean
to interrupt you, but
that's okay. I thought maybe I was like getting ahead of myself in topics here, but
I'm just stunned that you were joking around with Arturi Lehkonen.
Well, let's put it this way. I was joking. He was smiling. I don't have any insights into his soul. I don't know if he thought maybe he was just being polite, but, he was in a good mood, clearly. And so I said, does Yoel Armia, has he actually finally figured out that he's a good NHL player? And to which Lehkonen said, he goes, oh man, you need to talk to him more. He thinks he's awesome. Are you kidding? You have this kind of sense of a group. And I think continuity is part of it. I think the way that they are handled, by the coaches, I think is part of it. I think the way that, the veteran group and that the leaders, whether they're veterans or not, deal with one another. I think, all of these factors, amount to a club that actually has a pretty strong sense of self. And I think that probably I, speaking for myself, misinterpreted a lot of the doom and gloom that was around the team, in the 8 games where they didn't win, as a kind of a searching and like a, not a despondency exactly, but something relatively profound, when in fact it was just anger because they're competitive and they want to win and they weren't doing that. And I don't think that there was any second guessing of what they should be doing or who they are. I think it was just a question of a bunch of people getting away from what it is that makes them successful at the same time, and having difficulty channeling all of that stuff together and getting the oars synchronized again. And that's what I think is kind of the meta story in all of this here.
Well, I would agree with that. But by the same token, you know, it was so easily identifiable what was going wrong during that streak.
Yeah.
You know, guys doing other people's jobs, you know, like Claude Julien loves the Belichick mantra, you know, like do your job, just right. Do your job and let other people do their jobs. And as soon as you try to do someone else's job, everyone's job becomes more complicated. And so that's exactly what was happening, is that there were instances, clear instances. I remember one time Victor Mete sliding all the way over to check a man being checked by Shea freaking Weber, for crying out loud. I mean, he's like, what are you do? Who are you trying to help here? Shea Weber's there. He's got the guy. Why are you going over there to help? And puck was in the back of their net moments after that. And so this was just a recurring thing that, and so I think to a certain extent, I agree with you that the Canadiens do have a very strong sense of self. They know what makes them successful. They know what they're not allowed to get away with. Like basically they can't get away with anything. They have to be on their game at all times. They don't have enough talent to win unless the system is respected to a T. And they realize that. However, having realized that and all this veteran leadership and what have you, like a slide like that should not happen on a team that is built around these two pillars of leadership that should be able to get them out of what is clearly a mental situation. It's clearly just a lack of understanding of what they're supposed to be doing. And when you see them play as well as they've played over the last six or eight games, you're like, okay, good. Well, this is how they should play. This is great. They're playing better. They got out of it. They're resilient. You know, I mean, that was the big word in Calgary was the resiliency of coming back. And it's true. It was to me, resiliency means stick-to-itiveness, which is what they had. They kept playing the same way regardless of the score, and eventually it paid off for them. But what they didn't do during that winless streak is they didn't do that. There was no stick-to-itiveness to their game. There was no resiliency. It was just a snowballing thing that just got worse and worse. And this team can't afford lapses like that. So like, listen, like not everything is not lost, but what that eight-game slide did is it removed all their margin for error in the season. Like, they just can't have another one of those. They've already used it up. And it's unfortunate because the tough time of the season is coming now, and they could have used that cushion, that little streak, that slump that every team has, was probably pegged in their minds, but looking at the schedule, to come either now or in January when they play, like, 10 games in 17 days to start the month, or, you know, February, or like even March when they're basically on the road the whole, and they're playing out west, and like the rest of the schedule's torturous. And they've lost this one get out of jail free card that every team gets basically every season. You get one little chance to suck for a while. And if you suck again, you're not making the playoffs. And that's where the Canadiens are at now. Now they can't suck anymore for the rest of the season. They've used it up. I figured it out last night. To get to 96 points, they got to play like 595 hockey. So that's actually come down below 600. It was above 600 for a while, but this stretch now has brought them down to 595 to get to 96 points, which is what they had last season. They obviously didn't get in with that, but I think the way things are shaping up this year, 96 should get them in, just because the rest of the Atlantic Division is somehow sucks. Yeah. It's the worst division in hockey all of a sudden. And so if 595 is doable, but for this team, it's only you cannot lose more than two games in a row the rest of the way, basically.
I agree with everything that you say there, except I think the nuance is important, because you can have a bunch of things go wrong at once. So you can lose the forward who had been probably your most reliable offensive performer. You can lose your heart and soul guy, speed guy, who's like the Swiss Army knife in the lineup. You can lose Victor Mete. All of those things in isolation, I think, are survivable. I think they're not survivable as much if all of a sudden Carey Price is finding himself in the middle of his what appears now to be annual kind of November reset.
It's all about the mustache.
Is yeah, exactly. And then also combined with pretty packed schedule, some banana peel games, there are a lot of factors there, and I don't think any of them necessarily.
Wait one second. The schedule was not one of them. The schedule was in their favor that whole time.
Well, it was in
their
favor.
The most favorable part of the schedule.
Right. In terms of schedule strength, what I'm saying is in terms of the actual, like, they were playing at home. What I'm saying though is that in that month, they played 13 games in that month, which is not a huge amount of games, but they did have.
It's less than a game every 2 days. It's as good as it gets in the NHL. I mean, really, the schedule was not a factor. All the other things that you mentioned were definite factors that should be taken account for.
But they had two sets of back to backs though within a week, right? They did have all I'm saying is I'm not making excuses. What I'm saying is that it seems to me that you have a bunch of factors that come into account, none of which are fundamental to what this team is. In other words, like, yeah, they sucked. Yeah, they were terrible. Yeah, they couldn't afford it. Yes, it happened. But at the same time, this is a team that is the team that we see before us right now. It's not so much the team that we saw during that eight-game streak. And I think that is the belief in the room. The belief in the room is that they are not outside the playoff picture. at all, and that in fact this margin
because they're
for
not
error,
they're second in the division right, right now. But, I mean, they're not outside the playoffs.
But everything is so bunched up, and Tampa still has games in hand and everything like that. And what I'm saying though is that from the standpoint of inside that room, my sense of it is that the belief hasn't wavered, and that they think they have this, they think they can do this, and that it's not going to be a huge lift for them.
Well, I would hope so. Of course, they think that. That's their players on the team. I mean, I would
they
think
believe
that,
it. They believe it.
But Sean,
it's
there's a. I understand. Yeah, no, I know it's more than talk. Of course, they believe it. Listen, they believe it. You know, they literally believed they were going to make the playoffs. You know, 2 years ago.
Yeah. That's true.
Like in January, when it was beyond anyone's realm of possibility that they would, but they're professional athletes. Sure, they believe, and listen, they're not out of it, they're right, and they can play themselves into it. My point is that all the factors you mentioned should have been a reason for this team to really, really focus on what makes them this.
Right.
That was a time to really double down on their identity, and instead they completely departed from it for a long span during the most favorable part of their entire schedule, like a moment that had to be seized. And you could see, like, the way Claude Julien reacted to it, it was almost a dead giveaway that prior to the season, when the schedule came out, him and his staff had identified that stretch of games and said, this is our best time to make up some ground, to build a cushion, because after that, it's going to get tough. Because there was urgency in him. Like, it was after the second loss. I mean, Claude Julien was doing some drastic things.
Sure.
And, you know, I mean, he said, listen, I'd like to think I don't let losing streaks stretch on too long before doing something normally. But he admitted that, listen, we can't afford streak. Like, we can't afford losing streaks. And so I think it's a great sign that the Canadians have come out of it and they're playing as well as they have. And that's fantastic. And there's all sorts of positive things, and we are going to talk about the positive things in a minute here. It's just unfortunate, I find. And it's something that I think needs to be addressed, because it's the second year in a row that's happened at the exact same time of year.
Yep.
Where the Canadians have used all their wiggle room up before Christmas, like before December, before the second month of the season, or the third month of the season, I should say, their wiggle room's gone, and now they have no room for error anymore. And that's a tough, tough way to play for 5 months.
Yeah.
It's just hard to play and knowing that you have no room for error.
And I will say also, I think that some of the blame for this, in fact, probably a lot of the blame for this, lies at the feet of the general manager, in that this reinforces the need for a backup goalie you can trust. And I think they did trust Kincaid for a little while there, and then they didn't. And you find yourself in
I don't know.
Like, I think his first couple of starts, they seemed to not mind. I mean, like, you know, in October, he only played once every 10 days or whatever it was. But what I'm saying is, you find yourself in a situation where you absolutely have to be able to get stellar goaltending from your backup at least a couple of times in these kinds of dips, because you are going to, at this stage in Carey Price's career, have to accept that he is going to sometimes need to take a step back to make whatever technical adjustments he and Stefan Waite have made, or whatever he needs to do to get right, because the level of consistency that Price can deliver is not going to be increasing, I don't think, as he ages. And I think that's true of every goalie and of every hockey player. So it's not a slight against him at all. So I think that's an issue that it reinforces again. Now, I think probably given Primo now, they do have that guy internally. But this is something that that you're absolutely right, was avoidable and somewhat predictable in some sense, because you look at that stretch, you think, okay, this is how we line it up. And the second it goes sideways, there really wasn't anything they could do about it other than call up the kid when the time came.
Yeah, but even then, that was long after. I mean, you know, in the middle of that stretch, you know, I mean, well, basically, you know, Kincaid didn't play on that back-to-back against the Senators. Price played both ends when they were, what, in Columbus and then against Ottawa here.
That's right.
And so that was in the middle of that stretch, you know. Like, that was, they lose that game in overtime. They actually played pretty well in that game. But that was in the middle of that stretch, and that was where the bleeding could have been stopped by a backup goalie.
Correct.
That was ready to play. And Price played well in that game. He's not even the reason they lost. But the point is that who knows what the effect on Price was of playing those two games in the subsequent games, like the games that he played after that. You know, there's a certain buildup of usage that eventually, you know, catches. And Carey Price is actually one of the best goalies in the league when it comes to playing on back-to-back nights. I think his save percentage on the second night is something in the 920s. So it's like he's really actually quite good at it. But, you know, the reason you don't want your goalies doing that is maybe further down the line, it just catches up to them. And so that was an opportunity, and I agree with you. Like, that's one of the things. And the other thing that I think is not necessarily Bergevin's fault, but, you know, he signed Riley Barber to be sort of a guy who could fill in if a lot of injuries hit like they have. Mm-hmm. He signed Phil Verone to be that guy. He got injured. Mm-hmm. Alex Belzile would have been a possibility. He got injured. I mean, the injuries in Laval are extensive, and this was foreseeable to a certain extent in the sense that they had no major injuries last year other than Shea Weber missing the start of the season. They had little to no impactful injuries last season, and there was no chance they were going to go through another season like that, so they had to expect that. It's hit, and they weren't necessarily prepared depth-wise for this amount of injuries, but I don't know how many organizations would be, because you know, you take out your top scoring.
Yeah, Pittsburgh maybe. That's about it.
Yeah, Pittsburgh. Yeah, well, Pittsburgh. Very, very well, yeah, because Pittsburgh has Evgeny Malkin just sitting there waiting to like dominate every time Sidney Crosby gets hurt. The Canadians don't have that, but so yeah. I mean, I think you know people want to say excuses; they're just realities. But the fact is that to me, when the injuries hit, was a time for them. Like when you know when Price says, "Hey, whoa, we know what we are." Well, hell, you should have known what you were in November. So that you weren't in a situation where you had to go out west and win 3 out of 4, let's say, to have a successful road trip. And basically right. win, you know, 2 or 3 out of every 4 games the rest of the way. Like, you can't do anything other than that. You've painted yourself into a corner to a certain extent because you weren't able to identify how you were getting away from this identity that they all claim to embrace and love right now.
But here's what I think I'll say to that as well, is that I think that it's that they weren't who they are, and they figured out why they weren't who they are, and now that they are who they are, if that makes any sense, this is turning into a Seinfeld episode, Arpin. I think it's
you sound like a hobbit.
That's right. The feeling of it is that probably they are going to be able to erase. Like, let's assume for argument's sake that the winning percentage that they had going into that 8-game streak had held through those 8 games, right? Let's do that. So I think their winning percentage was somewhere around 570, 580, something like that, right? So let's say that they points percentage, forgive me. Yes.
Yes.
So let's assume, that in those 8 games, the 16 points, they come out of those 8 games with, what was it? 2 points? Three?
Three, I think, yeah.
And so the points percentage would have been 9, right? 9, maybe call it 10. So they leave 6, 7, 8 points on the table, except that now they've already made up a couple of those points, in the last 2 weeks. And if they can make up another one of those points in the next 10 days and another one of those points in the days after that, you find yourself in a situation where you don't need to win 8 in a row to offset 8 in a row, particularly with the loser.
No, of course
not. With all that stuff. And so I think now that they've kind of righted the ship a little bit, it seems to me that this is actually kind of an interesting experience for teams to go through. And I'll recall that, like, and I'm not going to compare, make a direct comparison between the 1920 Canadians and the 09-10 Blackhawks, but the 09-10 Blackhawks lost 10 games in a row the year they won the Stanley Cup. And that's the sort of thing that can sometimes happen to teams that have particularly young players and who are in situations where the margins are not great, but they have the talent and the coaching to get themselves through it. And I think that, again, I think that's like the big picture story to me is that.
Talking about erectile dysfunction isn't easy. Usually we just brush it off or blame ourselves, saying things like, I lost my mojo. Or we avoid it altogether with excuses like, I had a long day at work, or sorry honey, I'm just not feeling it. But with Roman, it is easy to talk about it with a real doctor who can prescribe real medication. It's simple, safe, and totally discreet. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for ED, all from the comfort and privacy of your home. The doctor will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, Roman will ship it to you with free 2-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward, simple, and discreet. Getting started is simple. Just go to getroman.com/support and complete an online visit. Erectile dysfunction used to be tough to tackle, but now there's Roman. Complete an online visit today to connect with a doctor and take care of it. Just go to GetRoman.com/support to get a free online visit and free two-day shipping. That's GetRoman.com/support for a free visit to get started. GetRoman.com/support. There are a few things that I feel like I would like to talk about now is like the reasons why they might be able to do it. Like there are some positive things, and you know, you mentioned Yoel Armia before, scores, you know, a very Yoel Armia goal in the sense that we see that shot in practice all the time. We haven't seen it so often in games since he arrived in Montreal at the beginning of last season, but now he's got this confidence to himself that he's basically never had. And, you know, Marc-Antoine Gaudet had, you know, a great story at the beginning of the week on Armia, talking to Darcy Regier in Buffalo, the main scout who'd seen him for the Sabres and what they saw in him to make him a first-round pick, and how they basically tried to beat all that out of him by making him into, like, a bottom-six forward who's, like, a defensive liability. So they just focused on everything he couldn't do rather than focusing on what he could do. And it took him all this time, took him going to Winnipeg, playing in the bottom six role, but being really good at it, and then suddenly becoming like a penalty killer and a defensive player and really an all-around player. And now, at age 26, all this stuff is coming out. And the way he's, like, that goal, like, there's so many of Yoel Armia's goals that I tell myself that, like, there are a handful of players in the NHL who could score a goal like that. Like, the goal he scored in Pittsburgh the other night when he bull rushed Chris Letang and got in really tight and roofed it from really, really tight up against the net. I was like, you know, there's like five players in the league who can do that. The goal the other night, the release and the velocity and the placement and everything about that shot. You know, you could argue that Rittich maybe should have had it, but man, like, did that puck come off his stick quickly from a position that I don't think any goalie could reasonably expect a shot with that kind of force would come from? And it's just like, again, I looked at that and I was like, how many players in the league can score that goal? 10? Maybe? I don't know. It's amazing what, like, how high the ceiling is on the plays that he makes. Like, the plays that he makes put him into a grouping of rare players. I'm not saying he's one of those players, but he has the ability to do things that those players, or only those players, are able to do.
It's remarkable, like, I guess it's recency bias here that's talking, but, like, to me, he looks like a 6'4" Brock Besser. Like, that's what he looks like. He is making shots around the ice that are surprising NHL goalies, whose bread and butter is to read players' intentions. And that's heart. And it speaks of an extremely high talent level. And I think that Armia is a guy who, regardless of what Lehkonen and others will say, I do think that he's had to get his head around the idea that, hey, wait a minute, I actually am a top six forward in the NHL. And I remember talking to him about that last year, and he's basically said, listen, we can have that discussion once I start playing on the power play, if that ever happens, right? Which at that point, he didn't know was going to happen. And so, all of a sudden, you've managed to, for essentially a bad contract, acquire a guy who might score 30 this year. And there's not a lot of guys like that in the league, and there's not a lot of guys like that who are 6'4", who can kill penalties, and who can play not exactly a mean game, but certainly a very physical game, and a possession and warding people off game, which is not something that a lot of players in that lineup can do, certainly not to his level. And so you find yourself with this player who is, I mean, what's he got? He's got 12 goals already. Yeah, his career high was 13. He would have beat that last year if he hadn't been hurt. But yeah, I mean, I'm consistently amazed by some of the things that this player can do. And it's interesting because in the National Hockey League, and I know this from having spoken to Regier on other stories in the past, particularly about Paul Byron, which is that your window to be what you ultimately will become is not big in the NHL. Like,
no, it's not.
You are, like, if you are a bottom six forward, if you are seen as a character, role player, whatever it is, then it's tough to not be that and let that define you. And I think that there's a lot of credit that goes obviously to Armia, who has worked on his speed and has worked on his strength and has obviously studied up what it is that the coaches want him to do. And he does all that good stuff. But it also, I think, speaks a lot to the vision of the pro scouting in Montreal, and also the fact that Claude Julien understood what he could do with this guy under the right circumstances, and so do the other coaches. And it's a really fascinating case. Like he just gets better and better. And he had another, like he had that clean breakaway, where he just clangs one off the post. And again, that release was nuts. Like Riddick essentially didn't move until the puck was by him. And you just look at this and you think to yourself, okay, where is the ceiling for this? And I don't think anybody knows.
Well, it's the one thing about him is that you rarely see NHL players marvel at someone else's skill.
That's right.
As consistently as the Canadians do about Armia's skill. Like every player on that team, if you ask them to talk about Armia's shot, their eyes will get wide and they'll just be like, dude, like, I don't know. Like, he has the best shot on the team. I don't know why he hasn't scored 40 goals. Like, they're in awe of it. And last year, like you remember when we were doing the player poll and every player after player, who has the best shot on the team? Oh, it's Army. Oh, it's for sure it's Army. At one point, I think it was Tatar. Tatar said someone else and Nick Delorier overheard. He's like, dude, it's for sure Army. And Tatar was like, oh yeah, of course. Yeah, definitely Army. You know, it was like, okay. And it was just like, and at the time, I think all of us were just like, isn't this weird? And then we started watching him in practice. We're like, damn. Yeah. Like, where is that in games? And now, you know, we're seeing him just get into spaces to where he can use it. And he's just thinking shot way more. And I think there's been a lot of people who have told him to do that. Like, he's, you know, Claude Julien told him all last season. I think his teammates have told him, everyone. But you really need a mentality where, like, if I have the tiniest sliver of space to let it go, I will. And I'm not going to look to pass. And I'm not going to look to do anything else. I'm just going to put it on net and see what happens. Like the goal again in Calgary, not necessarily a high percentage shot for 98% of the players in the NHL, but when you can shoot it like him, it has a decent chance of going in. And that realization, I think, is something that took him some time because it was so hammered into him to be a possession guy and to be good defensively and to do this and to do that. And it was never hammered into him to exploit a skill that he's always had in him, but that he's never really fully been encouraged or empowered to use until seemingly now.
And I think that's a really interesting point that you make, Harpin, because I think that there is a we underestimate, and so do fans, I think, the extent to which these guys are on short leashes, particularly if you're a role player, particularly if you're in a situation where you're in your mid-20s, you are not a big money, like sort of no-brainer 6-year, 7-year, 8-year contract guy. You're in a situation where very often guys will be put in these roles for X number of weeks and they'll look okay. And then they'll look a little better than okay, and then they won't look good, and then they'll get moved out of it and all that sort of stuff. And I think that when you become and you look at his career path, and Marc-Antoine's story, I think, really speaks to this, is that I think Yoel Armia probably was in the back of his mind, whether consciously or not, thinking to himself, well, okay, at some point they're just going to jam me on the fourth line. That's how it's going to be, because that's how it's always been since I came here. And so I think now you find yourself in a situation where he's had an extended run of games. Last year, the second half on the power play, he's been on the power play basically since day one this year. He's been playing top six, occasionally top nine, depending on like when Drouin's around, there's some moving around of the parts and things, except that he is now no longer, I think, living in fear of, if I blow this, if I miss the net on this, if I do that, he's earned a couple of extra mistakes before the coaches start to say, hey, you there, wait a minute. That's not it. That's not how this works. And I think that there's a level of comfort is a bad word, but there's a level of kind of confidence. There's a level of probably calmness and expectation that comes with all of that. And you see him cruising around the ice now And he's predatory. Like that, the goal that got chalked off in Vancouver on the mysterious interference call against Lekkonen. I mean, that was a goal scorer's play. That was a goal scorer's play. Yeah. He shoots it and then he goes and it's like he knows where that's going. And to me, you see him play with this kind of like a self-assurance that I think he's always had. It's just that I think he's not also a super boisterous personality. I don't think he's the sort of guy who thinks I am owed this. In fact, I think he's very low maintenance in that regard. And if his fate was to just be a grinding penalty killing guy who scores the occasional highlight reel goal and you think to yourself, why isn't this guy on the Olympic team? I think that would be okay with him on some level, right? I don't think he has an outsized ego, or feels that he is due anything. And now that he's actually showing that he can do all this stuff, and feeling comfortable with it, I think he's rolling with it. And I think the more he develops that, yes, I can do this and actually here, get out of the way, I'm gonna shoot this puck. Watch, hey guys, check this out. Then I think you're gonna see more and more of him putting shots on net that goalies aren't gonna be able to deal with.
Yeah, I agree. And you know what? I mean, speaking of self-assurance, I just want to finish up with getting your take on something. Someone who comes from the same town as Armia, Jesperi Kotkaniemi, who's on this trip, is skating on his own or sometimes non-contact with in practice and what have you, and we'll see what happens today, but is inching closer to the lineup. The World Junior Championship is coming up. He is eligible to play in that championship. There are people who believe that it would be good for him to go as a quasi-conditioning stint and go play in that tournament and work on his confidence and blah, blah, blah. And you know, I don't think Bergevin flat out said no to that possibility when he spoke to you guys in Vancouver. But I'm interested to get your thoughts. What say you if this becomes a situation where he's ready to come back, the team's doing pretty well without him, he hasn't played in a while, let him go there, play for his national team, get some games in over there, and then come back a la Victor Mete when he went for Canada and get back in the lineup and just go on his merry way. What do you think of that possibility?
I don't hate that. I don't know necessarily, though, that he's in the kind of headspace that would make it a productive trip. In other words, he would have to want to do that. He would have to be into it. And I don't know that he isn't. I don't know that he is. But I do think in theory it is actually a very good idea. And I think that Mete is the example I think that I would point to as well, because I think it did his game a bunch of good. This being said, I think when you look at the circumstance, yeah, they're playing well. But I think if Drouin was healthy, if Byron was healthy, if they were doing all of this with something close to an optimal lineup without Kotkaniemi in it, I think maybe I would be more inclined to want to try and nudge him in that direction, because I think ultimately in terms of his development, going away, being with a bunch of Finnish kids, and I think he would dominate that tournament without any question, or be one of the dominant forces in that tournament without any question. It can only be good for his confidence, but at the same time, I think they're going to need him. I think, you know, yeah, Suzuki's looked really good in that role. But ultimately, I mean, I don't know how long I want to ride, the Riley Barbers of the world, and people like that. And I think that, they're a pretty conservative organization. And I think probably that Kotkaniemi at this point thinks of himself as an NHL player, not as a guy who, is going to learn anything or benefit from playing with, junior age guys. But at the same time, I don't hate the idea at all. And I think that there's a national pride thing.
He's never played in that tournament.
He's never played in the tournament, being closer to home, all that sort of stuff. And like, and in Finland, lest we forget, like it's almost as big a deal in Finland, might even be a bigger deal in Finland than it is in Canada. And so, you know, are the Finns in any way kind of trying to sway him in that direction? Maybe they are. And it'll be very interesting to see how they decide, because this is a decision they're going to need to make, real quick. Like, that's probably going to happen, I would imagine, in the next 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why I wanted to bring it up now. And then, and just to pick up on a couple of things you said there, you see, I'm of the mind that they shouldn't do it. And here's why, because it's the same reasoning I had actually going to Laval, because,
yeah.
of what you said. He sees himself as an NHL player. Is he in the headspace where he can look at that as a positive and say, okay, I'm going to go there and get more ice time and more this and get development time with the coach and this and that and that. All this is good for me. Or is he just going to go down there and say, okay, I've failed. I am no longer in the NHL where I once was. I have now have to work my way back there. What happened? How did this happen? He's only 19 years old. And I don't think going to the World Juniors would have that same connotation because it would be a unique thing. But here's the thing I have about the World Juniors is that Victor Mete is one thing, because Victor Mete could go there and kind of have a good tournament, but not great, not outstanding. And as it turns out, he did have an outstanding tournament. But if he didn't, no one would be freaking out.
Yeah.
If Jesperi Kotkaniemi goes to the Czech Republic and is just okay, like it's just fine. Like he's a good player, but he's no better than some of the draft eligible kids playing, or, you know, Alexis Lafreniere or whatever. I mean, like, he's no better than any of the other good players, and he doesn't dominate. He doesn't dominate the way an NHL player should. So there's no potential for a win there, because if he goes there and that happens, that's bad. Like that's, people are going to be like, oh my God, he couldn't even dominate against his peer group. What the hell? Why is he in the NHL to begin with? This is horrible.
Right.
And if he does do it, like if he does go there and dominate, everyone's like, well, yeah, he should dominate. He's a top three pick in the NHL. He's played in the NHL he's the second year in the NHL. I would hope he'd dominate. You know, it's like there's no win. Like you can't win doing that. Like the only win is to say, instead of sending him for a conditioning stint in Laval, we're sending him for a conditioning stint in the Czech Republic to play for his country. And that's the only way to frame that, where it's clear to him that you were going to get you some games so that you can build yourself back up to NHL speed, even though the World Juniors are nowhere close to NHL speed.
Yeah.
But still, it's an experience that can be enriching and that you will enjoy, a tournament you've never been to. So between that and Laval, we'd rather send you there. That's basically it. And we'd like to get you some games before you come back. But it's just that, if he goes with any expectation, like I just feel like the expectations for these guys are never met. Mm. Like Barrett Hayton, for instance, this year, like I think the whole country's expecting Barrett Hayton to dominate the tournament. I don't know if he will. And frankly, it's cause he's 19, you know, like, I mean, these guys, they are the age that they are, and they're playing against other 19-year-olds. And so, you know, I find it hard. It's such a delicate balance in the sense that just by sending him, you're already putting like an ounce of doubt in the confidence of a kid who is by nature extremely confident in himself, but has a whole bunch of reasons this season for that confidence to be waning to some degree. And he's been pretty open in saying that he's been not good so far this year. He's not happy with how things have gone. He's aware of it. And he's a little bit confused as to how to get out of it, you know, and this is something that I think is a normal thing for a second year player, especially at 19. He's still the sixth youngest player in the NHL.
Yep.
And so it just strikes me as doing anything that would take him off the NHL team is a big risk. And you better be really sure that it's the right thing to do if in fact they do it, which I don't think they will.
So you know what? You've convinced me. Partly because as I'm listening to you talk, I'm thinking to myself, I'm looking back at last year's tournament and thinking about Nick Suzuki, who was okay. He was fine. Right?
He was bad. No, he was bad. He was not good. Mark Bergevin went and told him that after the tournament. He went to him and said, you did not have a good tournament. You need to be better. And then he went out and did what he did in the playoffs after that.
Exactly. And sort of, it seems to me.
Which is pretty extraordinary.
Exactly. But I mean, there was a low grade freak out and he hadn't played a game in the NHL. And I think the only reason that they would do this is if Jesperi Kotkaniemi thinks it would be cool and wants to do it. It's the only reason. Yeah. I really think it's the only reason.
Which he won't, but he would never do anything that would take him out of the NHL.
And that's what I think as well. And I look at him. Right. I've been around obviously the club a little bit, not behind the scenes necessarily, but like you know how it is on the road. You have a little bit more access to these guys. You see them, and he is working very hard. And he seems like a guy who is not happy to not be playing, but at the same time he's like, look, it's cool. I got this. It's fine. And I think that they see him as an NHL player. He clearly sees himself as an NHL player. I mean, the only, you know, I actually do think that the freakout might be bigger if they sent him to Laval than the World Juniors. But then again, you're right. I mean, are you going to take the risk of him not performing well or getting hurt again or whatever? I don't know. Like, I wouldn't do it. I think they're going to stay the course. I think they're going to stay the course because they need him in the lineup fundamentally. And whether or not
that's what I agree with you is that this is a moot point. This is a moot discussion because they do need him. You're right in the sense that if they had everyone else back, this is something they might consider. But they can't consider it right now because they need him. They do.
Throw him out there with Suzuki. Cousins on the left wing.
Paling, Kotkaniemi, Suzuki. How would you like that?
Why not? Honestly. But I mean, it'd be great.
But
honestly.
So think of, okay, let's look at this scenario. Let's say the tournament starts next week, and Cole Caulfield scores like 2 goals in the tournament. How is the city going to react? Yeah. It's just, you know, this is the environment. Like, I don't personally think the World Junior Championship is the healthiest environment in the world. It's good to like know how players react under pressure like that, but it is a short tournament. Sample size issues are abundant. People make way too much of how a player performs in that tournament, mm-hmm. and it sticks to that player. It can stick to a player for a long time at a time when they're very impressionable, where their confidence might be a little bit fragile, and before their career has even began. Like, you can be – like, Jake Virtanen, I think of him. Like, whenever I think of Jake Virtanen, I think of the World Junior Championships and how the numerous brain farts he had over and over and over again. And that's all I remember about him. Like, whenever I think of Jake Virtanen, that's what I think of. And it's like, you just do not want to have your entire career tainted by something, by this one tournament over 2 weeks when you're 19 years old, and you have this long career ahead of you. It can make you, like, you can be Jonathan Toews or Carey Price or someone else, like, you know, a bunch of other people who've just took that tournament and used it as a launching pad for their career.
John Carlson.
But there's countless, tons of guys. But there are tons of others who have had their entire careers defined by something they did at 19 years of age over a Christmas holiday, when they made one bad move in one important game, and it stuck with them the rest of their lives.
Or conversely, Cody Hodgson, great, go dominate the NHL now. Right?
Exactly.
The 2009 tournament was the first one that I covered, and I remember having an eye-opening moment, because I was captivated by, I mean, it's, you know, you had Tavares there, you had PK Subban, you had Jordan Eberle, you had lots and lots, you know, Eric Karlsson, all these players, Victor Hedman, like everybody was there, and it was amazing. But the thing is that I remember sort of talking at one point about sort of, oh, you know, there's an element because there's the momentum swings and all this sort of element of purity. And Nikita Filatov, God love him, who at that point had been sent back from the Columbus Blue Jackets. In fact, a very similar case of a player who'd been pretty good in his rookie year, struggles in the second year. They sent him to the World Juniors and was never seen or heard from again. But the point is, Filatov sort of looked at me when I asked the question in the mix zone. He's like, listen, we're all professionals here, right? And I was struck by that. I was like, well, I guess you are, aren't you? Really? And it's like, okay, wait a minute here. I'm going to remove these rose colored glasses for a second.
Yeah.
And look at this for what it is, which is, again, you're right, a vaguely grubby business, and a short showcase that can go well for some, but, you know, goes very badly very often for lots and lots of others. And so, right, I think we're on the same page as this. I mean, I would be really surprised that Kotkaniemi had a burning desire to play in this tournament rather than play in the NHL. But, I mean, I don't know. I guess we'll see.
Yeah, no, I think I'm pretty confident in feeling that that's not going to happen. But I do think there's a good portion of the fan base who would like to see that happen.
Sure.
And, you know, I think that's why it was important to discuss it, because I think it is something, assuming he comes back either tomorrow in Edmonton or Monday in Winnipeg, which you would think he would, because that's why he came on the trip, because they thought he might. So we'll see. But in any case, we're going to end it on that. It was great talking to you, Sean. I'm glad you made it to Edmonton. I think the Canadians are practicing shortly. So I'm going to let you go and get ready for that, to go and see them, skate circles. And, in the meantime, I will eagerly await your arrival and, remind our listeners that we will be back on Monday with, our subscriber only mini pod. Marc-Antoine Godin has promised that he will be back for that one. So I won't be shivering the entire time because he's not around. So that'll be good. And that'll be the last day of Sean's epic road trip to Western Canada. Thank you, Sean, for joining us. And thank you for covering the team on this trip. That is quite a slog, and you're doing excellent work, so keep it up.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say, Arpin. Thank you. It's actually a lot of fun because I have lived and worked in several of these cities over my career, and it's actually kind of fun to catch up with some old friends and go visit some old haunts, some of which are a lot darker and scuzzier than I remember, I have to say. But anyway, what are you going to do? So it's great fun, and I'm pleased to be along here, and thanks for having me.
All right, great. And I will have you know that on Sunday, there's a high of 3 degrees in Winnipeg. Monday is -7. So you have avoided the entire Arctic chill that you anticipated on this trip. I'm a little upset about it, frankly, because I kind of wanted you to have this bad weather. But you apparently are not going to get any of it. So, yeah.
T-shirt weather. That's
yeah.
Right. T-shirt weather in Winnipeg.
Sunday for your arrival. It's going to be +3.
Outstanding.
This is a joke. This is a total joke. All right, Sean. You take it easy. And to all our listeners, thank you for listening. And we'll be back Monday for our final show before Christmas, with Marc-Antoine Godin and myself. Until then, have a great weekend.